This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I wanted to start by acknowledging the past and present traditional owners of this land on which we're meeting, the Ngunnawal people, and it's a privilege to be here today, and it's a privilege to actually be with all of you, and I hope we're going to have plenty of time later actually to continue this discussion and to share some of the cookbooks that people have brought in. I feel a bit like I'm at a dinner party where I've kind of over-invited, because the original idea was that I thought it would be a fairly small group and we'd all kind of share each other's insights and have a look at the cookbooks, but we're going to do it a little bit differently. I'm going to start off talking a little bit just about my own interest in food culture, and then I'm going to introduce the kind of study of cookbooks as historical evidence by looking at some of the collection that's come from the National Museum. Then we're going to break up and hopefully into small groups where people will be able to share and talk about the cookbooks that they've brought in. And then we're going to come back together and share some of those insights. So I hope that's going to work, because I think the most productive thing for us to be doing today would be actually to be looking at the things that you've brought in. But I'll just start by providing a few of those kind of hints about how you can actually read them. I'm here on a visiting fellowship. I'm from Southern Cross University. My interest in cooking started, or food generally, started primarily when I was doing my PhD, and I was retracing Columbus's voyage and looking at the quincentenary, and it struck me how Columbus had actually gone to the Americas, bumped into the Americas on his way to the east looking for spices. And it seemed to me that it highlighted how central food is to culture, and yet it was something that had been neglected for such a long time. I think in history books we've spent a lot of time talking about visual culture and written documents, sometimes at the expense of other senses. Taste and smell would be two of those in particular, I think, that we haven't paid as much attention to, although they are in fact so central to our culture. I'd argue that you could probably find out almost everything about how a society functions by looking at the food that it eats. By knowing what someone eats, where it comes from, how the food's obtained, who prepares it, and with whom it's consumed. I often ask myself, what's more interesting than what someone had for dinner? For most of us, food's not merely about sustenance or about nutrition. We would eat more insects, for example, if we were just doing the right thing by our own health or by the environment. So, in fact, it's actually something that really goes to the heart of our own culture and our own personal history. It's also not just about cooking, and cooking itself is a form of entertainment. I was talking a little bit before about Jamie Oliver and the way that we actually watch people now cooking on television to entertain ourselves. Food's not also just about eating. Eating itself is a kind of a form, a marker of social position, of social mobility and so on. Knowing about certain types of ingredients, in a way, is a form of social capital, and a kind of, it provides some sort of social mobility for people as well. Food isn't just about ingredients, recipes and dishes, because the choices people make are also about their personal history, they're about style and presentation, what's available. And it's not just about geography. Where once people might have been limited to what was available to them locally, now people are able to enjoy and consume ingredients that are either purchased elsewhere or grown from things that have come from somewhere else. So food, in a sense, is also a really good marker of changes in communication, in travel, immigration, power, and money. And food's not just about nutrition. What we eat has social, cultural, and moral meaning. The project that I'm doing at the museum is actually looking at the relationship between agriculture and cooking. I'm interested in the way that our changing tastes also have an impact on land use. I come from an area that was once had a very thriving dairy community, and I live on an abandoned dairy farm that collapsed in the 1950s. And so it's very clear to me when I look around and I see the macadamia plantations that are there and the avocado farm trees and so on, that the way that, our own tastes have had a big impact on how we use the land. I'm inspired in this by the work of Wendell Berry, and I've put one of his quotes up on the slide. "Eating ends the annual drama," he said, "of the food economy that begins with planting and birth. Most eaters, however, are no longer aware that this is true. They think of food as an agricultural product, perhaps, but they don't think of themselves as participants in agriculture. They think of themselves as consumers. If they think beyond that, they recognise that they are passive consumers." Berry advocates reclaiming our responsibility for what we eat as an agricultural product, and understanding that eating takes place inescapably in the world, and that how we eat determines to a considerable extent how the world is actually used. Food's not merely an agricultural product in that sense, and the landscape is shaped by consumption as well as production. Food's also historical, and it tells us a lot about the historical moment that we actually live in. When the English came to Australia, they left behind a land of damp forests, changing seasons, and a climate that supported permanent agriculture. It was relatively cool and it was damp. Few of them were farmers. The salient features of their own time and place were rural exodus coupled with incredible urban growth. They ate a lot more meat than their neighbours, and that had a lasting impact on the way that Australians ate. Fresh fruit and vegetables supplemented a diet largely based on cereals, tubers and dried beans, and the varieties of fruits and vegetables that were available to them. The kitchen garden followed the garden calendar. The kitchen garden, though, expanded with colonialism. By the middle of the 19th century, the growing needs of European food markets as a result of population growth, industrialisation, urbanisation, revealed the basic incapacity of European agriculture to fulfil them. The role of colonial economies became increasingly important. One of the most significant aspects of the contemporary economy in the 19th century was the cultivation of new land to provide the market with food. And in Australia, developments in the food industry, above all in things like preservation and refrigeration and decreased transit times, marked the 19th century and shaped a landscape and eating habits. By necessity, native produce was an important part of the diet for many colonists in the 19th century, but few differences in food preparation show up in early Australian recipes. People tended to take their food preferences with them, and when they did actually cook with native produce, they tended to use familiar kinds of herbs and spices and methods to make it something that was actually familiar to them. Mina Rawson, for example, recommended eating pigweed as a substitute for lettuce, or using kangaroo tail instead of ox's soup, as Isabella Beaton's recipes did. But that didn't necessarily transform the English into Australians. The heritage of Australian cooking has grown from those Indigenous foods and from the legacies of colonialism and multiculturalism, cultural exchange, the local region and the larger world. And these resonate in our landscape and how the world is used. Far from being bound then by geography, culinary cultures can inhabit multiple times and places, and food becomes a way of kind of mediating those things. The culinary products of the mother country, for example, had a very different meaning in Australia. Louisa Meredith complained in the 1840s about being constantly served cured cod and salmon that was imported from England rather than native fresh fish, because it was something that it was considered important to do while she was in Australia. Colonial tastescapes then were constructed through Australia and Europe, and through the consumption of food as a way of building the idea of home. So eating those foods became a way of producing that sense of home and that sense of kind of familiarity. That's still sometimes the case. People will, when they talk often about proper meals, talk about the sort of meals that they had when they were children and the sorts of meals that they shared with their family. So that food becomes a way of producing both that idea of a family and the idea of home as well. Food in that sense provides a really material site, a tangible kind of link to the past and a record of that. And so cookbooks and other sorts of food then is important as an object of study in their own right and not just as a blueprint that we might use them otherwise for to make a meal. I'm going to limit my discussion of cookbooks just to some of those that are held in the National Library. There are, in Australia and New Zealand, there are now about 13,000 cookbooks that have been produced in the last 200 years. And so actually trying to cover some of the main sorts of changes that have gone on in things like illustrations and changes in recipes and so on almost defies description. So I'm just going to bring up some salient points that you might be able to use when you're looking at your own cookbook, and they'll come up as points. Until the late 19th century, Australians largely relied on cookbooks that were brought with them from England and their own private recipe collection. And that influenced then to a large extent, the sort of food that they ate. In the first book of recipes that was published in Australia, the English and Australian Cookery Book that appeared in 1864, Edward Abbott evoked the roast beef of Old England. Oh. The use of such a potent symbol of English identity in the 19th century may seem inevitable to us, and colonists who could afford them tended to use their English cookbooks and the ingredients for many years, even after Abbott's publication. New ingredients were often adapted to fit in with familiar culinary expectations in a new setting. Abbott often drew on native and exotic ingredients to produce very familiar dishes that used English methods and principles. Things like kangaroo stuffed with beef suet, breadcrumbs, parsley, shallots, marjoram, thyme, nutmeg, pepper, salt, cayenne, and egg. It wasn't until the 1890s that a much larger body of Australian cookbooks became available, but by this time, the food supply was widely held to be secure and abundant, and the cultivation of exotic foods in Australia like wheat and sheep and cattle had established a long and familiar food supply for English colonists. National cuisine then in that sense can be seen to be a construction that sometimes hides the legacies of colonialism and change. We could think in that sense, for example, of how English a cup of tea seems, and yet tea isn't something that was necessarily grown in Lancashire. By the time Edward Abbott was advocating rabbit curry as an Australian dish, it was the English invention of rabbit curry and curry powder that was actually being absorbed into Australia rather than necessarily Indian cooking itself. As Uma Narayan says, the appropriation of Indian cultural artefacts was easier for those in England who didn't have to distinguish themselves from their colonial subjects. So the British in India were spending a long time trying to import the luxuries of their own British cuisine, while at the same time in England they were actually beginning to experiment with curries and curry powder and so on. Classics like kedgeree and mulligatawny, which became part of an established part of the British culinary repertoire, also became part of Australia's culinary inheritance from Britain rather than necessarily from India. Curries in particular were a regular feature in Australian cookbooks, but rather than appropriating Indian food into their diets, the Australians were eating British curries. Mrs. Beaton's cookery book is a good example of the popularity of British cookbooks in Australia. Beaton's kangaroo tail curry was included in the Australian cooking section of her Household Management. And I've got the recipe there. The things that are kind of worth thinking about in terms of looking at your own cookbooks, one is that it's one of the first times, because Beaton was started writing in the 1860s, that ingredients were clearly distinguished from recipes, from the method themselves. And this presents lots of problems, actually, for publishers still. There's debate about whether that should necessarily be the case, because it takes up so much space on the page to actually do that. The other thing is that we can see that there's a clear method starting to be developed where people are being quite systematic about the steps that are needed to be taken. But those steps aren't clearly distinguished from one another. So within the one sentence, you actually have two or three different sorts of tasks. It also requires, to some extent, a degree of discretion and knowledge and experience of cooking. So Beaton suggests adding things to taste, cooking something until it's tender, that kind of thing. So you have to actually have a little bit of experience or be around the food for a little while to be able to fulfil the recipe in the first place. The meal also takes between 2 and 3 hours, which would be quite prohibitive for a lot of people now. And I know in lots of the new cookbooks like Delicious, they've got those recipes that you can do in half an hour or 10 minutes or whatever, and you don't actually see very many of those historically. By 1900, Australian interest in native food had pretty much dissolved. Mrs. Beaton's Cookery Book and Household Guide, published in 1892, gave a selection of Australian recipes, but they were primarily for the British public rather than this assumption that they were being cooked in Australia. Kangaroo tail soup was cooked in the same way as oxtail soup. Roast wallaby was compared to hare. The ingredients were wallaby, veal, milk and butter. And parrot pie was said to be not unlike one made of pigeons. They're all prepared in ways that make them fairly familiar. And this conforms to what the Rosens have called the flavour principle of when you introduce new ingredients into a particular cooking. So a really classic example of that is potatoes. The French didn't like potatoes for many, many years until they discovered that you could cook them with cream and wine and herbs, and then they loved them. So if you can introduce something new but use the same sorts of ingredients, you often then can proliferate the spread of those. The means by which ingredients were introduced to different regions reflects cultural exchanges, historical processes, and the local environment. The adaptation of recipes to incorporate local ingredients likewise provides information about local traditions and conditions. And so you start to see those ingredients then as a bit of a two-way movement between looking at what might have been familiar to people and what might have been something that they had to make do with because of what was necessarily just available to them at that time. So the ingredients, when you're looking at your own recipe books, are an important source of information about what was available to cooks and also what was sufficiently known about those ingredients. But they also tell us, they're also a record of what people didn't cook with and what they didn't like to use as well. So for a long time you don't get garlic, for example, in Australian cookbooks. And it was the same really in England, and some people credit Elizabeth David, somebody's got an Elizabeth David book here today, with the person who kind of popularised garlic in English cooking. Differences in the level of practical cooking knowledge also have a vital role to play in cookbook literature. Colin Bannerman and others have suggested that the shortage of domestic labour in Australia was the thing that supported the growth of the cookbook industry here in the late 19th century. The poor quality of Australian cooking was also an occasional theme in the press as well during the same time. The message was generally the same. Bad food affected Australians' physical, domestic, social and moral well-being and impeded progress towards civilisation and higher culture. And the idea was really that Australians had to learn how to cook. People often commented on the quality of the ingredients and so on, and said that they were more widely available than they were in England, but much poorer in quality. So the cookbooks, in that sense, emerged as a way of teaching people. Among the first to teach cookery skills was Mina Rawson, author of Antipodean Cookery Book and Kitchen Companion in 1895. The book was a compilation of her own recipes and remedies, and it was organised and simplified food preparation for the ordinary housewife. But the book also included directions and guidance on things like household tasks and how to cure diseases. So they weren't, the cookbooks weren't completely separate. They offered much more than kind of culinary advice on how to cook a particular meal. Mrs. Rawson also knew that people had to make do, and she included a lot of bush foods that you still don't get in a lot of Australian meals. Things that people could substitute for the English ones that they were used to, like pigweed. Plain cooking, though, was still considered to be the standard of the day, and that was something, in a sense, that had a lasting kind of impact in most cookbooks and journals for a long time in Australia. By the end of the 19th century, cooking had become a recognised classroom subject, providing early training in domestic service, and textbooks teaching Australians how to cook also flourished. Measurements became much more uniform, the layout of cookbooks became more standardised, and the procedure was clearly spelled out. This allowed companies to be able to sell their foods because it meant that you could duplicate the recipes and that they would kind of taste the same. It made them easier to use. The audience for these cookbooks were mostly young women directed to cooking as a way of encouraging social harmony. Cooking was elevated in lots of ways at this stage as a social responsibility. The Victorian Education Department Supervisor of Cooking and the Domestic Arts, Flora Pell, believed that schools should provide the training for home life that was being eroded by a tendency for girls to become typists and secretaries and clerks, rather than housekeepers or homemakers. Public opinion, said Miss Pell, had begun to demand that schools shall provide for children such training in citizenship and homemaking as shall rise up a strong race of well-nurtured people, skilled not only in the right conduct of their own lives, but impatient of the existence of any conditions unfavourable to the health of the community. Among these conditions would rank decline in household skills and a weakening of maternal instincts, traceable results of the employment of women outside the home. Flora Pell was considered to be quite an authority on cooking during this time. Our cookery book, one of the most famous book that she published, which came out in 1916, ran into more than 30 editions. It was still coming out in the 1950s and still in lots of ways provides a really good a collection of recipes that can be easily followed as well. There are only minor changes in the content during that time. So some cookbooks are known because of the people who wrote them, and also because of their endurance, which is quite important. The Common Sense Cookery Book that was first published in 1914 has just been re-released, and it doesn't look that much different to the one that I used when I was at school 20 years ago. And I don't know how different it is, you know, from the one that came out in 1914. Both Flora's book and the Common Sense Cookery book were wartime releases, but there's not a lot of difference, actually, in the cooking style and the ingredients. It's more the idea that cooking itself is a sort of a social responsibility that seems to be significant for the timing of the books. In Tested Cookery Dishes, Pell argued that the service that cooking provides to the race. The housekeeper, she said, is in a position to wield a tremendous influence on the mind and body, hence upon the family, society, and the nation. Pell thought that that cooking was far more important than art or music or anything else. It was something that was really significant. Cookbooks then can also be seen as a representation of domestic life, and historically this prescribed the activities of men and women as being quite different. The dominance of women in cookbooks in the 19th and early 20th centuries attested to the strength of that idea of having separate spheres. The consequences of this, though, have been debated by historians. Whether, in fact, having that particular kind of market and the identification that women were making with each other also provided a forum for women's voices and so became quite significant in women's politics at a later date. The Home Science Cookbook advised teaching girls to cook. She'll be a wife someday and you can make her early married days happier by teaching her to cook now with Wade's cornflour. The audience for this ad is presumably other women, mothers who have a role in cooking education. A vital role of cookbooks was to teach women how to use new products, and these were often incorporated into new recipes. Food companies also began to print recipes on their packets and release their own cookbooks to promote their products. Davis Gelatine produced its first free booklet in 1904, and other companies followed suit. Cookbooks were a strategic marketing device for products and appliances. The largest gelatine factory was in New South Wales, and according to Davis, it bathed in sunshine and freshened with the light breezes of botany all year round. The interesting thing about the gelatine cookbook for me is that I was quite used to using gelatine for sweets and things, but the cookbook has a substantial number of savoury dishes as well. So there were lots of kind of pureed vegetable dishes all cut up into cubes of different colours. There was a fantastic lobster dish, and I don't know what this says about the cheapness of lobster at this particular time, but it had lobster, vinegar, green food colouring, prawns and salt and pepper, and it was done in a jelly mould that was just, you know, magnificent to look at. These were the first lavishly illustrated Australian cookbooks. The miniature recipe cookbooks that were produced by Mother's Choice Flour in the 1940s provided another example of the link between advertising and food. Doreen Wilson, who donated the recipe pamphlets to the museum, describes waiting for them in eager anticipation, and she used to copy them for her own glory box while she gave her mother the originals, which her mother eventually gave to her when she got married. Five perfect recipes were presented in each pamphlet, which is about this big, and they were presented by June Clyde, who was an American actress, quite well known at that time. Such books were an attempt to promote new foods and also sell local foods. Many of those were overproduced, things like milk. The Milk Board came out with recipes for milk soup and all sorts of things to promote the consumption of milk and dried fruits as well. The Australian Sunshine Cookery Book was used to popularise the consumption of dried fruits and promote their health benefits. And it was seen, you know, in the winter it would be something that people would be able to use to continue their fruit consumption. We were just talking before about pineapple and, you know, recipe books that came out and cooking those sorts of things as well. And the interesting thing about those was that there was a concern amongst some food authorities at the time that what was going to happen in terms of the production index was that people wouldn't necessarily eat more fruit or more vegetables when there was more variety, but that they would cannibalise the market. So if you ate pineapple, it would mean that you might not eat apple or, you know, something like that. So there was a bit of a concern about whether the variety in fact was necessarily a good thing or not. Diet and nutrition became a concern even as food companies were entering the market, promulgating new ideas, new recipes and increasing variety of foods that were ready-made, things like tinned meats and vegetables. So cookbooks in some ways reflected the changing tastes of the public and their ideas and what they were doing in their own lifestyle, but they also helped to promote some of those sorts of changes too. So the nutrition issue becomes quite significant when there's a whole lot of new research coming out also on foods. It's clear from the number of books that were named Tried and Tested, the value that people put on recipes from their peers and the importance of food that worked rather than food that just looked good in a glossy magazine, which we've had a little bit of discussion about today. Australian Home Cookery, published in the 1920s, provided tested recipes and practical hints on marketing, invalid cookery, preserves, pickles, beverages, parties, carving, table arrangements, preparing meals, and culinary terms. The choice of foodstuffs, they suggested, was as significant as actually cooking the food. And some of their hints are really useful. Like, I didn't know how you could tell a fresh apple. Does anybody know how you do that? So it's a great book published in the 1920s. You play with the stem and see whether it snaps or bends or how old it is. So some of that advice would still actually, you know, isn't necessarily things that we've necessarily inherited. It's not clear, though, whether cookbooks were necessarily used. There are some that have lots of sign of wear and tear. And you, when you look at your own cookbooks, sometimes you can tell the pages that they might open out to and know the recipes that were used. Sometimes there'll be spillages, and I've got a few of those. The pages could be stuck together, which is quite difficult. You need to get some advice about how to do that, how to get those open. And sometimes people actually wrote in the cookbooks things about method or things that they might have wanted to change or something that they found more useful in the recipe, like the almond essence that you were talking about that you added to cupcakes. And so when you're looking for signs of use, sometimes those things can be actually quite helpful. Michael Simons has suggested that community cookbooks that were compiled from below, rather than the cookbooks that were designed by home economics experts and so on, were much more likely to be used. And so things like the CWA cookbooks were often made from compilations and collections of recipes that members of the association actually sent in. And what he did was look at recipes that had historical kind of importance in Australia, and whether those things actually appeared then in the recipe books. So things like Afghan biscuits and Anzac biscuits and pavlovas, which he knew that people were cooking, you could look for those and see whether the book's actually useful or not. Cookbooks like the CWA cookbooks, which emerged in the 1930s, showcased a lot of the recipes that crop up in what's been called the golden age of baking in Australia between 1900 and 1930. If you look at cookbooks produced in that time, and it's also a way generally of looking at books, you see that there are a lot more recipes for biscuits and cakes. Australians inherited the kind of Victorian love of afternoon tea and often baked their own recipes and biscuits and cakes and so on for that. They also had a lot more meat dishes often than the cookbooks that we have now, and a much smaller variety of vegetables than we might be used to. And so you can look at those sorts of recipes too in terms of how they may have structured the day. How long did they take? Were people getting together for morning tea and afternoon tea? How were they eating them? Did you need to actually sit down to eat them and so on? And so the cookbooks can tell you really a lot about the kind of movements and how the day was punctuated. Many cookbooks were readily available before World War II, but the average household didn't have that many cookbooks. It's worth considering now how many cookbooks people may generally have and whether, in fact, they use them or not. People have suggested, Barry Smart has talked about gastronomic pornography, because people are kind of looking at the books really for the pictures and not necessarily using them. But up until World War II, people were most likely to be cooking recipes from their own private collections, swapping recipes with friends, and cutting recipes out of magazines, which I know people are still doing in doctor's surgeries all over the country. And they often shared those and used those, in fact, to cook with. Changes in family menus were more likely prompted by newspapers and magazines than changes in cookbooks. The Australian Women's Weekly appeared in the 1920s, and like a lot of women's magazines at that time, always featured recipes that people shared. The quality of those changed significantly in the 1950s. It became much easier to produce kind of glossy, colourful magazines at that time. And so that, in a sense, also had an impact. By the 1950s, one in four Australian households had a copy of the Australian Women's Weekly. So it's a very difficult thing to ignore as something that contributes to our food culture, despite the fact that it's seen as popular and everyday and ordinary. It's the 1950s, in fact, that I'm most interested in, because it's during this period on the North Coast that there's a downturn in the dairy industry. The dairy farms either get bigger or they shut down and people move into different things. It's also a time when cars and refrigeration, television and supermarkets heralded such a massive transformation in food in Australia. And cookbooks contributed largely to this. Recipes for children and teenagers start appearing, acknowledging that there's different tastes according to age and according to different sorts of identity. The almost universal 9-to-5 working hours meant that women outside paid employment did all the shopping, that they learned to drive and that they took their cars to supermarkets. There's a lot of discussion about the design of parking spaces in supermarkets because women were assumed to be such terrible drivers. The formation of consumer groups like the Australian Consumers Association and organisations for housewives provided a forum for activism just at the same time that women's place in the home was also considered to be venerated. Lobbying for better, cheaper food, better quality food, and a ministry of housekeeping showed how central food was to women's politics in the 1950s. The Housewife's Day, which was a survey that was done by a marketing organisation prepared for the Australian Sales Research Bureau at the end of the 1950s, showed that women spent an average of 4.5 hours a day on meals. That was preparation and consumption and washing up. There was a London survey that the Australian survey was modelled on, and they found pretty much the same pattern. And it didn't matter what suburb you lived in. It was like every woman was spending a significant amount of time on the preparation of meals. There is a change with ages. And there are some other patterns that emerge. Bread and meat were most frequently the most frequently purchased products. And fish on Friday, people were 4 times more likely to buy fish on Friday than any other day of the week. And I don't know whether that's still true. Do some people here buy fish on Friday? And they're my friends. So that's interesting, isn't it? A lot's changed since the 1950s. Already, younger women were said to be spending about 1.5 hours less on cooking a day than women who were over 46 in that survey in the 1950s. The suggestion was made, because they were interested in marketing, was that younger women were more likely to use tinned food and prepackaged food, or that they had appliances that would have made their life a little bit easier. And this, in a sense, points to the significant paradox that's at the heart of the 1950s dream, that at once they had this domestic goddess whose central life was said to be in the kitchen, and was the centre. But simultaneously, that was bound up with this acquisition of appliances and technology and different sorts of food that was meant to free her from the same thing. The cookbooks of this period largely promoted the new domesticity, including those that came as supplements to the Women's Weekly, produced through cooking competitions and to promote the tours of overseas cooking experts. Books for Cooks was a book that was launched by Dion Lucas, who was America's Blue Ribbon cook and was on television programs in the US. She was a graduate of the Cordon Bleu School of Cooking in Paris, and she also helped to open a Cordon Bleu school with Rosemary Hume in London in the 1950s. It's interesting, she was such an expert, but it's not really clear that the recipes were in fact used. So in that early Cordon Bleu cookbook, for instance, there's a recipe for risotto, and it says that you shouldn't stir the rice. You just have to leave it, because otherwise it would end up being gluggy. So I don't know if they ever actually used it. And what did they do with their glass of wine? The school and its publications attempted to revive the splendours of pre-war cooking to a post-war generation. There was already a sense of nostalgia for a world that was lost. With all the labour-saving devices that were available to women, Mrs. Lucas believed that they would have plenty of time to be able to devote to the highly skilled art of cookery. In the same issue, though, Mrs. Lucas commends Kiora tinned soups for hungry husbands who just can't wait. And there's a fantastic ad for Rinso during the same issue as well, where Mrs. Chapman proclaims how wonderful it is to have a work saver like Rinso. She's the mother of four lively children and still finds time for art classes, tennis and a lot of entertaining. So definitely go out and buy some Rinso, I say. But Dion Lucas felt that men were actually the best cooks rather than women. She thought that women didn't have the stamina or the imagination to be great cooks, but with practice you could actually be better than you were. So the 1950s is kind of full of all of these sorts of contradictions. At the same time, men's cookbooks appeared, like O for a Man Who Cooks, and there's a copy of that in the museum, and it was compiled by the Society of Gourmets. It actually followed their first publication, which is O for a French Wife. So they were trying to cover really both areas. The Society proclaimed that the enjoyment of good food and wine wasn't a luxury, and they said since you had to eat, and you may as well extract the most enjoyment out of it as possible. And there's also a kind of a strange thing that's happening too with the idea that food is cooking and enjoyable, that it wasn't a task or it wasn't arduous or it wasn't something that women should be acknowledged for necessarily in the home, that provides that other kind of contradiction that's happening. Food was becoming a popular means of elevating social position. The Society of Gourmets went so far as to claim that garlic definitely has a place in some good cooking. And so actually experimenting with that gave people a sort of a sense of social capital or cultural capital as well. International cookbooks began to multiply in the 1950s, sustained by changes in society and migration, communication. Some of the Australian dishes in those fell back on the stereotypes that were in those early sort of 19th century books, using things like kangaroos and wombats, which few Australians during the 1950s would have actually had experience of. One of the authors, Robin Howe, said that the average Australian will do his best to insist all cooking follows a pattern laid down by his forefathers, usually from the British Isles. But Howe could see that there was some difference and there was the beginning of a kind of a culinary culture that was changing and developing its own customs, especially, he said, in the country. Unlike Beaton's recipe for kangaroo tail soup, Howe also included three cloves of garlic in the one that he produced. Explaining the reason for cooking, Isabella Beaton put forward an historical account of the shift towards increasing enjoyment of it. In the past, she said, only to live has been the greatest object of mankind, but by and by, comforts are multiplied and accumulating riches create new wants. The object then is to not only live, but to live economically, agreeably, tastefully and well. Accordingly, the art of cookery commences, she said, and although the fruits of the earth, the fowls of the air, the beasts of the field and the fish of the sea are still the only food of mankind, yet these are so prepared, improved and dressed by skill and ingenuity that they are the means of immeasurably extending the boundaries of human enjoyment. Everything that is edible and passes under the hands of cooks, she said, is more or less changed and assumes new forms. Hence the influence of that functionary is immense upon the happiness of the household. I hope people think of that when they're cooking themselves. Beaton anticipates a growing trend, not just towards cooking and eating, but an interest in what sustains us, cooking as a form of recreation. And the history of cookbook publishing provides a glimpse into some of those things. The sorts of points that I've raised are the things that you might look at when you're looking at an individual cookbook, but if you look at them collectively, there's also a number of themes that emerge. Increasing rates of literacy, which facilitated the growth of an industry, wouldn't have necessarily been possible if people couldn't read and use the books. There's also the dominance of particular nations, the idea of French cooking as being as being gourmet cooking, the prestige of imported foods, and the movement in more recent cookbooks towards regional cuisines. You can look at cookbooks in terms of what was eaten, by who and how, who prepared the food, and so to whom the books were actually directed. And really clever books like Isabella Beaton's were directed at both domestic servants and at wives, which made them gave them actually quite a big market. There are also changes in the inclusion of themes. Economy, frugality becomes quite significant, organisation and management at different times. Changes in the extent of detail. Changes in authorship, whether it's women, men, doctors, health professionals, home economists and so on. There are different purposes for cookbooks as well. Many of them were used to fundraise. On the north coast of New South Wales near Nimbin, where I come from, there's a hemp cookbook, which is used against prohibition of cannabis. So there's a kind of a political reason for some of those cookbooks as well, and a relationship between food reform and civic life. Promotional literature produced by food and kitchen equipment companies were a form of advertising and quite significant to the history of cookbook publishing in Australia. The influence of cookery school and home economics movements, advice on etiquette and entertaining, the influence of immigration and travel, the creation of culinary stars and authors, of which we're all fairly familiar. Apparently Jamie Oliver's books, for example, didn't sell very well in Australia at all until the television shows started to appear here. So we may be looking at cookbooks because of how they work, but it's also about who we know that makes them significant. Changes in ingredients, changes in advice about health and domestic medicine, the impact of social consciousness. So I was talking before about the way that during the war cooking was seen as a kind of a social duty and so on, but there's a proliferation of cookbooks now which are about green kitchens, about using things that are kind of in your local environment, vegetarianism and so on, and all of that kind of reflects changes really, or the impact of changes in social consciousness. And the diversification of the social class of readers that's made cookbook publishing now so diverse. It's necessary, obviously, to place those changes in a more general historical context, but in fact cookbooks for a long time have been ignored as a source of information in their own right about the period in which they were published and the kinds of social and political changes that we can see coming through a lot of the cookbooks. And so in that sense, I think they're quite important in order to be able to read them as well. When you look at your own cookbooks, which we're going to do now for this second part of the seminar, I want you to consider some of those themes that have arisen in the discussion, but you'll also have insights yourself that I haven't necessarily got to. So what I'm going to do is give you the sheet, maybe if somebody could record some things. When we come back together in half an hour, it'd be great if some people who were able to, I'll have a microphone, could bring back some of the things that they want to share with us about the cookbooks. Because cookbooks are really so diverse and there's so many different things. And I know some of you will have used the cookbooks, which in a sense is a really interesting and another way that you can learn about cookbooks. At this stage, we're just using them as a text, but I'd encourage you to actually do that kind of active process too of cooking with them as well, because that in itself becomes a kind of a way of imagining the past in quite different ways than historians are often used to. So I'll hand out some sheets, and it's 10 to now, so we'll come back together at 20 past 3. Thanks, everyone. We're going to come back together now. You don't have to actually move because I've got a microphone, so I'm going to walk around. I've had a little bit of time to talk to some people, and I know that people have got some great things to share. Also very useful tips for the sorts of things that they found out about their cookbook and how they found those things out, like how you can date them, what the ingredients say and so on. And if you'd like to actually put your cookbook up on display while you're talking about it, we can also just put it up here on the overhead, and it'll show the recipe or something. So if you want to pass your cookbook, we can do it that way.
So I'm going to actually start with these two women in front of me who haven't known each other before, but who actually bought in the same cookbook, two different editions. And so they've got some things to share about the differences between those.
We bought in 14 books between our group of five, but the one we've chosen is one that two of us bought in, a 1931 edition and a 1936 edition of the Bundaberg Branch CWA cookbook. The 1931 edition has 240 pages, the 1936 edition 176. The reason being, the 1931 edition has several pages of advertising, none in the 1936 edition. The layout, just there you'll see above pea soup, you'll see four diamonds or squares. And when we look at the 1936 edition, between recipes, we'll see three diamonds. That was the only difference we could detect in the layout of the books. There are several other differences, but maybe someone likes to speak about another book.
That's fantastic. Thanks for that. The people that were at the front had what was called a coronation cookbook. Where are they? Oh, and that was quite a difficult one to date, so I think it actually showed some quite interesting things about how you can actually work out the dates.
Well, when we look at the advertisements in the front of the book, it's for fuel stoves, a tin can washing machine, so they'd only just gone all electric. The other thing was that there was a reference to a Japanese flyer who'd flown from Tokyo to London, so we know it was pre-war. Probably about the mid-30s, we'd guess. Very well used, yes.
Why you are, I'm sure.
Not my book. It was priced at 2 and 6.
So, I mean, you can look at things like the price, you can look at the advertisements. Sometimes the names of particular people will be mentioned, and they may have manuscripts that are held in the National Archives or the National Library. So you're quite lucky, actually, in Canberra that you've got access to some of those sorts of resources. But that was really interesting. Would anybody else like to share something from the books that they were looking at?
This cookbook, the Electrical Women's Association Cookery Book by Mrs. McKenzie. It's the third edition, published in 1914. And just the ads on the inside, yeah, if you just leave it there for a second, on the left-hand side, an electric kitchen means freedom. And there's a lovely lady all dressed up, ready to go out because the kitchen's nice and clean, and obviously that's all done. She can go out now and enjoy the rest of her day. It's a basic cookery book, and over the pages, it's got a lot of the section one devoted to the electrical appliances and how that can bring freedom for women in the kitchen because of the time-saving appliances. And it goes on to describe a couple of interesting pages there with, yep, safety first. There's a page for children and also a page for the menfolk. And we know there's one for children and the menfolk because it's titled Page for Children and Page for Menfolk, just around the dangers of electricity in the home. It's certainly targeted towards basic cookery, but also selling electrical appliances as well.
This woman actually has the same cookbook. This is a quite useful exercise, but it was put out by a different company.
I was just going to say it was published by St George County Council in Sydney, and don't know what date it is because there's recipes stuck all over it. It was my mother-in-law, and so I don't know if it's the same edition or not.
This is more like Ricky Lake.
If you could show the two that have got those sticking out.
This is not a published cookbook, it's a home cookbook. It's by my grandmother who came from Yorkshire in 1911. She wrote this cookbook from 1931, so it's a Depression era cookbook. It's very delicate, but I'll just show you the recipe for mock brains, which takes a cup of rolled oats, boiling water, parsley and onion, and when it's well cooked and thickened, put it in the basin to set. Cut in slices and fry a nice golden brown in egg and breadcrumbs, salt and pepper. And the other recipe that we'll just show you, among many interesting recipes in here, are two variations on the right-hand side for making coffee. The first is from wheat, with salt, sugar, brown in oven, put through mincer. And the second is 2 cups of bran, oatmeal, I think, salt, and with black treacle and brown well. No chicory, no. These are from Toowoomba, these cookbooks.
Thanks for that.
I'm sorry I didn't bring it today, but I do own over a French wife and over a man that cooks. I was given them in the late 1950s, and I still use them. What was unusual about them were the first recipe books I ever saw which gave a story behind the food and are very chatty and tell little anecdotes about it. And maybe we've come back to that today because now we're discussing food and including recipes in detective novels. Those of you who read Cary Grant would like. So, yes, I still love the recipe there for chicken merengue and how to make a slobbery omelette.
Well, those books are quite rare as well. So, you know, they're held in museums and it's often quite difficult for museums to get access to some of the best used cookbooks because there's such a big market for them privately and people tend to keep them in their own private collections as well. So there's a really rich kind of resource of private collections of cookbooks that exist.
This is a beautiful book that belongs to Christine herself, and the book was given to her by her mother-in-law, who was a lady's maid at... Where, Christine? I can't read.
In the Falkland Islands. She was a lady's maid in Government House in the Falkland Islands. She was born in 1918. Her brother was a gardener and her other brother was a chauffeur. And the edition of the book is actually 1906. So I suspect that she maybe acquired it while she was at Government House, and when she left the Falkland Islands in the 1950s, she took it well all around the world with her and ended up in Australia. And she used it to cook right up until her 80s. She died recently when she was 90. And it was her favourite cookbook, and she gave it to me before she died. So I do treasure it, and it has some fascinating information in it, not just about recipes and cooking, but household management, who you pay, how much you pay for, and then even advice about how to treat syphilis and consumption. So there are whole chapters on those types of things. So I'll leave.
Yeah, there's not very many photos. That one of the various soups, I think those were 9 different sorts of soups, but they're all orange and green. So there's Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management, and the main sections in it were for the mistress and servant, the hostess and guest, menu making, the home doctor, the sick nurse, home lawyer, I don't know, home lawyer, marketing and trussing and carving. In terms of the ingredients, lots and lots of meat, fish, offal, and lard. Butter was too expensive most of the time, probably. Also, a lot of use of gelatin and lots of salt. Even as you saw, the coffee recipe in that other little book had salt in it. So the audience was for, it looks like the whole world that spoke English, but there was a section called Australian cooking that was only a couple of pages, and one of the recipes was for Melbourne pancakes. Let's see, there was a cute thing, a title of one of the recipes was brown soup from tinned mutton, so that probably tasted fantastic. Let's see what we've written. Not many pictures in terms of design. I think there's only about 5 pictures in there.
Yep.
But as you can see, it's a tome. How many pages are in it, Christine?
Several thousand. Yeah. 2,500. Great. And it's quite white.
Interesting thing about Isabella Beaton is that she died in the 1860s, and a lot of her books came out afterwards, and she died when she was really quite young, 29, did you say? Yeah, but she's quite well known.
This cookery book is the first one that I remember being given that was my very own, and it's quite good because it has step-by-step illustrations. It was published in Australia in Melbourne. There is no reference to tropical fruits in it, because in those days we just didn't have them in the southern states. The only thing that is mentioned is pineapple. The curry that is talked about in that, I think, was on page 40. I might be wrong there, but it's curry powder, of course, and not the individual spices that we would use these days. The range of vegetables that were used and described on page 48, there's rabbit pie, yes. That was rabbit instead of chicken because there was a rabbit plague and we used to use rabbit whenever we could. Chicken was a special treat. The vegetables that are used are very basic ones, nothing exotic at all, the things that would grow in the southern states, or did grow in the southern states. There's a lot of use of milk products, cheese, and on page, I think, 92, there's a junket and blancmange, which don't seem to feature too much in cookery books these days. The good thing about it was the step-by-step illustrations. That previous page, oh, there it is. Suet pudding. I don't know whether anybody ever uses suet to make puddings like that, rhubarb suet pudding, these days. There's an illustration of the latest washing machine, I presume, in the corner. And what looks like a steam basket over on the sink, but I can't find out by looking at it what it was actually used for. I still use it occasionally because it's got such clear step-by-step illustrations.
And did your mother teach you how to cook as well, or you mostly use the books?
She tried.
Well, this cookery book is called the, as you can see, the Canberra cookery book, which we think it is actually in relation to the location rather than the cookery range. It is undated, unfortunately. It doesn't even have an author, but was produced by the New South Wales Bookstall Company Limited. It's obviously, I'd say, early century Australian and belongs to my partner, was inherited from her grandmother. And I think you can see, well, you can't really see from the break up the chapters, but, you know, it includes things like invalid cookery, soups, savoury and breakfast. But it also goes into things like medical hints and toilet recipes, which are at the back. And I have marked that one, if you go to the back there, right at the back of the book, which I think indicates that the book wasn't just meant for cooking, but for living, basically, covering a whole lifestyle. It had 20,000 issued as a print edition, its first print edition, so it was obviously widely spread. And it was obviously funded by a lot of advertising throughout, right at the beginning, but on each page there's a line of the sponsor for the particular page.
I mean, it's interesting because you're in slow food, so we're just doing a little plug for slow food. And one of the things about slow food is eating local food. But in those early cookbooks, there wasn't a lot of variation for the region necessarily. Did you find any?
Well, it's got a section, it's called, right at the beginning of Good and Tried Recipes, but a special section devoted to jams, preserves, pickles, sauces and bottling. So obviously for people who have the capacity to grow their own fruit and veggies, etc. What we did do, though, as part of the slow food thing earlier in the year, we, with the Canberra Museum and Galleries, we put on a winter warmers sort of exhibition, if you like, and cooked various recipes, and some came out of this book, and cooked was a rabbit pie with suet crust pastry, which was actually quite nice. And the interesting part of that was that you used boiled eggs sliced up to thicken the sauce within the pie itself.
I have an even older copy of Mrs. Beaton. Mine's 1898, and it belonged to my grandmother, and now I have it, and I shall pass it on. And it has been rebound, but from the first page onwards, saying that it's printed by Ward Lock, it's the original pages within. And it's got lots of quite delightful little illustrations, beautifully done little illustrations, how you could decorate your desserts, for example, that sort of thing. And a whole lot of things at the back, very useful household management stuff, like how to gopher the frills on your blouses or pillowcases with a gophering iron, which I no longer have, unfortunately. And it tells you how to behave, look after the sick in the sick room, how to be your own doctor as well. Lovely book. I'm very lucky to have it.
Thanks for sharing that. Even up until the 1950s, according to that household survey, 1 in 10 women were looking after sick people at home. So you can understand why they had separate sections for invalid cookery, which they don't anymore.
I have here a Goulburn cookery book, 11th edition, which I brought along today in the hope that someone might tell me when it was published. It's obviously a very long time ago. But I thought it was interesting looking at the preface when we were talking about why cookbooks came about. And in this one, the compiler author has said, Although there hardly seems any necessity for another cookery book, yet I cannot but think that this collection of recipes will meet a want, especially among the women in the bush, who have often to teach inexperienced maids and would be glad of accurate recipes that anyone with fair intelligence could carry out. I have tried to leave nothing to chance, and the vague counsels to make a nice light crust for a pie or a batter as thick as cream find no place here. However, any dish to be successful must be mixed with brains, and want of care and patience will often spoil the best materials. Our little group's been wandering through the books, just having fun reading them, and we thought the cure for diarrhea in here was rather amusing. 40 drops of oil of peppermint, 80 drops of laudanum, and half a pint of brandy. Mix. Take 1 tablespoon in the same quantity of water. Repeat the dose in 10 minutes. If the symptoms are not relieved, continue taking the medicine at intervals of half an hour, for adults only. There is a book here which will be familiar. This will pick out the ex-South Australian, particularly ex-Adelaide.
There's a woman here who has the same cookbook as you. I'm just going to pass the microphone to her.
This is the 8th edition, and it says 1910 for the Golden Cookery Book. Actually, can I just mention an idea that I was going to turn into a cookbook, and my brother turned it down because he thought it was going to invade my mother's privacy, but I'm going to go back to it again. I was thinking of doing a family cookbook in which I got all the members of the family to talk about their memories of when they made the food and when they ate it and how they felt about the food. And so we'd have all these little essays about not just the recipes, but the actual experience of eating it and making it.
Libby and I compared notes on our two different cookbooks because mine was post-World War I and hers is immediately post-World War II, and they're vastly different. Can I just say about your diarrhea one? It's this exact same one in my book, and it's this book is early 1920s, but it did add that it was effective for the English cholera. So you might be able to find out the age of your book, because it didn't even mention... Did it mention the English cholera? It did. Okay. So maybe there's similar. And mine's a Methodist edition. But I'd just also like to add that for the nurses in the room, they were using egg white for the bed sores in this book too.
Do you want to talk about your book?
Oh, yeah. This is the new Australian Cookery Illustrated. We've lost the covers, so I can't give it an exact date. My husband gave it to me to bring along today. It was the first cookbook that his parents had when they got married, and they married just after the war in 1946 or 47. So it's pre the 50s, but it's one of the first post-World War II cookbooks. It's published by the Herald and Weekly Times, I think, and it would have been published in Melbourne. They lived in Carlton. I think that picture is really interesting because there's recipes in here for Halloween food. And as a mother of a young child, I every year around the end of October, I have this argument that, you know, Halloween is not an Australian tradition and it's this American importation and we're, you know, cultural imperialism and what have you. But in 1947, they were obviously recommending a whole range of Halloween treats. So perhaps it's an ongoing argument. What was so interesting in the difference between the two books was just the diversity of ingredients that was used in this book. There's no bread baking section in this book. It contains a lot of, you know, basic family cookery, domestic cookery, preserving, jam making. But there's also a lot of recipes for very smart buffets and drinks based on champagne, canapes, what have you. So clearly, the intention is that you shouldn't just be a good household manager, as I think you were expected to be in 1920, but also that, you know, there's a glamorous life, a glamorous post-war life awaits you when you've left your job and gone back to the home. So that was quite interesting. Yeah, but the range and diversity of ingredients, I think, in 20 odd years. Was struck us as most amazing because Marilyn's book seems to be mainly based on what flour, eggs, milk and sugar, and dripping, lots and lots of dripping.
Yeah. Thank you. The first book I'd like to share with you is the red one, Mrs. Beaton's cookery book, 1891, beautifully illustrated, and it even has French and German cookery in it as well. But it's beautifully illustrated, as you'll see. And we might switch on to... Oh, sorry. And it's even dated, the lady bought it, had it in 1893, which is quite an early one. And we might switch to my Country Women's Association, which is my hat, everyone. I brought along one of the very early calendars that CWA of New South Wales published. This was first published in 1930, and there's a whole collection of them, cake and afternoon teas. They also did puddings. They did meat and fish recipes, and a dessert for every day in the year. You can see it starts off with January. Other branches of CWA put out cookery books, and one of them called the Buffalo Cookery Book, which is put out by the CWA of Northern Territory, and it really has some wonderful recipes in it. There's another one, the Wallala branch of CWA, that has recipes as well. And there's a CWA Hints and Recipes for Microwave Cooking, and this is from Western Australia. Another one I brought along is Australian Dried Fruits, which are wartime recipes. And there's also a Kookaburra cookery book, which is very similar to the Mrs. Beaton's issue. And there's also the Department of Agriculture in Victoria, Preserving Fruits and Vegetables. And there was another one, the Goulburn Cookery Book, which my friend behind me had a copy of as well. But this one has a photograph of Mrs. Rutledge from Gidley in Bungendore, whom you may know. Yeah. So there we are.
Is that your own collection, or have you purchased them or been given them? That's fantastic.
There was mention of the Coronation Cookery Book. Well, I'm delighted to tell you that Murdoch Press are in the process of publishing the latest issue, and it should be out, I think, any day now. Thank you.
This is Flora Pell's cookery book that I referred to before. Flora Pell was quite an authority on cooking from the sort of First World War period right through to the 1950s and 60s. There was somebody down here.
This is the recipe book of my grandmother, who was from the late 1890s through to the early 19th century. Her father owned hotels up and down the north coast, and she helped him. It lists the several of the hotels they were at, living at, and she wrote all these recipes out because she helped him with the catering. His hotels were always known for... He kept a good table, my mother said, and so I think Grandma was helping, but most of the recipes are for cakes and puddings and chutneys and things like that. And when they finally settled in Woolgoolga, which is between Coffs Harbour and Grafton, the next door to the hotel, the Seaview Hotel, there was they ran a billiard hall, which my grandfather ran, and once a week they used to run a picture show, and Grandma used to make all these cakes and things for supper at the picture show.
You don't get that at Hoyt's now, do you?
I think the other thing about biscuits and cakes is that you need to be quite precise with the measurements, which is why you would need so many recipes for them as well. Anybody else? Alison. Alison's got a cookbook from her mother.
This is not an Australian cookbook. It's a Ceylon cookbook. And I say Ceylon because it was published in 1956. So it's actually a wonderful snapshot of a country that's moving from European to a Ceylonese ingredients. As you look down the luncheon menus, the first page there is all English and Dutch and Portuguese and so on. And as you turn the page, yes, you'll see things like biryani and plantain curry and things like that starting to come in, string hoppers, mulukatani, lamprey, all of those things. And then you go to the more formal menus for dinner. So you can see that it's a nation in change. There you can see some of the utensils that were used in a Ceylon kitchen. The one, number 8, is for making pittu. which was a steamed combination of semolina and coconut and flour and so on. There you can see some of the Dutch and Portuguese sweets that were common to a Sri Lankan tiffin. But the other thing that's, oh, and that, you know, the various kinds of cakes and so on. But just a bit further, this is my mother's attempt. All those recipes there, handwritten, were my mother's attempts to find the perfect love cake recipe, which is a cake that is made with semolina and 25 yolks of eggs. Each one that had to be put into the mixture, and the mixture was then stirred for 20 minutes. So it took a long time to make, as you can see.
There was one group that our group came up with. Although our books were all simply written, they assumed that you already had some basic techniques or knowledge.
Yeah, they certainly didn't go into as much detail about what it meant to knead or any of those things.
The book that's coming up now is actually a reproduction of a book published in 1758. It was the first cookbook published in America, and it was also very popular in England at the time. And it just shows how, you know, isolated the early colonial wives were, because they had to cope with such a huge range of dealing with accidents and sickness, and as well as the recipes. And they used huge quantities of cream and eggs and sack, which I think is sherry, and brandy was also very popular. Their cure for diarrhea sounded pretty good to me. It was making cutting circles of toast about the of bread about the size of a crown and toasting it and soaking it in French brandy, and then just before bedtime eating the toast and supping the brandy, and that all sounded quite good. This one is such a nice chatty book. It's, and I love her name. This cook's called Hildegonde Duckett, and she lived in South Africa, and it's just like what was available on the farm during the different seasons. And she published a previous book and very often referred you to that, so that you had to go out and buy that one. But there's lots and lots of recipes, and dealing with problems about the dogs getting into the grapes. The dog would eat these bunches of grapes when they were ripe, and I wouldn't have thought a thought of having to keep the dogs out, but they're both very lovely books to to browse through, and they give you just a look into that time, that period in history. So
It is interesting the way that people do talk about how to kill things, and Escoffier, for instance, would talk about how you should use shellfish while it was still alive and that kind of thing, how you could stop it from biting you while you were trying to pull the shells off. So they're quite different to what we would do now. Did anybody else want to speak?
My grandmother prepared this book for her daughter, my mother, and dated it 1929. And as you can see, it's been very well used. My mother was a nurse, so when it started to fall to pieces, she stuck it together with elastoplast. And so there's heaps of recipes for cakes and pastries and some meat recipes in the front. But if you turn it around, at the back, she wrote a number of recipes and hints for curing things. And although there's not one there for diarrhoea, there's one for toothache, where you mixed up mustard and put it behind your ear. And then following that, there's instructions on how to turn the heel of a sock and how to make soap and various types of cleaning agents. And so it was really quite a useful book, but other people have also written it in at various aunts, and I've also added some recipes, and my children are now fighting over who's going to get it when I die. So I think I will, though, try and have it conserved in some way so that it doesn't continue to deteriorate.
That's actually quite a nice one to finish on, because it's now 4 o'clock, and I think it's been wonderful, the books that people have brought in to share and also their experiences of those cookbooks. And handwritten cookbooks in some ways remind us really of how cookbooks are one of those things that you need to also interact with. And so either, you know, writing them yourself or changing the recipe is really important. And in that sense, it kind of, for me, it was a really important thing that I learned about study as well, that it was actually about the doing and it was about the reading and it was about the idea of reading as being something that was really active, that I think cookbooks gave me that other books didn't necessarily give me when I was younger. I'm going to put my email address up there, and I'd really like to continue the conversation with some people. Some of the books that you've brought in are gems, but it's also in the reading of them, I think, that's the most valuable, that when they're sitting on their own, you really can't tell the stories that are behind them. So thanks, everybody, for sharing those, and I hope you continue to enjoy cooking and reading. Thanks very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.